Hello, everybody.
Hello.
My name is Brittany. I'm Tri-School's online learning manager, and our course instructor, Christina Feldman, has joined us today to offer this Q&A session as a chance for you to pose any questions that have come up for you in taking the course. I will ask if you're not already to please mute yourself just so that we don't get feedback. And if you do want to ask a question, you can do so by raising your virtual Zoom hand. That's under the React button at the bottom bar of the Zoom window. On my end, it shows a little heart. You can click that, and then the raise hand will show up. And we'll have an hour for your questions today. Christina will kick us off with a very brief meditation. And again, please just mute yourself if you're not asking your question. And when we do move into the question portion, we'll call on you in the order that we see your hands raised. Or if you do not wish to speak, you're also welcome to type your question out and I can read it to Christina. So that is all the housekeeping. Christina, thank you so much for your time today, and I'll hand it over to you.
So welcome everyone. It's lovely to see you. Lots of familiar faces and new ones also. So let's start with just a couple of minutes together, just so that we all arrive in the same space. So just finding a posture for your body that feels like an embodied intentionality of wakefulness, of engagement, of curiosity, of befriending. As wholeheartedly as we're able to, inhabiting this body, inhabiting just this moment. Mindful of the body sitting, the body sensing, the body listening, the body breathing. So thank you, and thank you for joining this evening. we very much enjoyed in putting this program, this course together, and we do hope that you're finding some value and some benefit in it. So we have just under an hour together, and really an open space for you to bring forward any questions or reflections that you have so far from the program. And I really encourage you not to be shy. Yes, don't leave the questions lingering. And it really is quite lovely to hear your voices. Okay, so the space is yours. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Christina. I love these classes. You know, I've been seeing you since you've been traveling over the pond to IMS here in the States. So I've been taking all of these classes, and every one of them seems to be, do this, and this will give you leading the good life, and this is how you're supposed to be. And so not that this is any less important, but I think it's kind of the feeling I'm getting is all roads lead to nirvana, or all roads will lead to just being more loving and open-hearted and living the life that feels authentic in this time. So I'm just curious as to how this is different from some of the other classes and courses and teachings that you have. My impression is that it's just the components that you're teaching us to lead that way. Would that be correct? So this is more gradual awakening, you know, the five factors of awakening, and while others are more the Eightfold Noble Path type of thing.
I think what inspired us to put this course together was the reality that many people don't have, you know, so much of a picture of where the many roads take us, as well as the good life.
What is this about?
That not so many people have a clear picture of what the Buddha had to say about the third noble truth. You know, that yes, we know, you know, we hear Nibbana mentioned, we hear the end of dukkha mentioned, and yet in many Dharma circles, it still remains something of a taboo subject. You know, we talk about lots of things, but we don't talk about Nibbana, you know, and we don't talk about awakening. And yet, as the Buddha put it, you know, this is the heart of the path. And I know, you know, in our cultures today, many people have a little bit of an allergy to, you know, words like goals or destinations. But when you read the early texts, of course, it is absolutely peppered with goals. You know, starting at the very core ones of what does it mean to live, you know, really a life of integrity, to the really big questions of what does it mean to be awake? And this is what we hope to the material or the discussions in this course to go into with a little bit more depth and focus. Yeah. Brittany, you got your hand up. I don't think that's.
Yeah, I put it up just to reflect the, if there's a question in the chat I'm going to read. We did receive a question from Elizabeth that said, is there a feeling or emotion associated with delusion? Grasping and aversion are more real to me because I can feel them. Is there a way to sense delusion?
Well, it's a good question. I think there is. I think delusion does have an affective tone. You know, I think it has an affective tone of, you know, just being floundering, just being lost, just kind of a lack of clarity, a lack of focus. But I think more this sense of just feeling confused. feeling confused about what's going on. And I think that is a very powerful affective tone. Yeah. Mike, are you there?
Yeah, just petting my cat. Yeah, I'm trying to get a feel for, the topic, Nirvana. And then I come from a MBSR background and a few classes with Anayo on compassion and awakening. And so one way to conceptualize or think about this, and I'm just wondering if it's consistent with what you're headed for. So like on a spectrum. On one end there's reacting, the other end is responding or no reaction, and that would be nirvana. And so it's just kind of a matter of degree of less reactivity.
I think a little bit more than that would be my perspective.
And
Because I think what the Buddha is speaking about is really the uprooting of ignorance. So there's no roots anymore for greed or for hatred or for delusion. And often in the early texts, the language that's used is kind of negatives. The Buddha talks about cooling the fires of greed, hatred, delusion, of non-greed, of non-hatred, and of non-delusion, which actually doesn't really sound very descriptive. But I think we're really kind of invited to think about what does the mind of a Buddha look like? What does the heart of a Buddha look like? And I think it's a little bit more than non-reactivity. I mean, reactivity for sure is how we articulate greed, hatred, and delusion when they're operational. But what does it look like to have the ignorance removed, the distortions removed that actually generate greed, hatred, and delusion? The Buddha speaks about awakening as about an unshakable liberation of the heart. An unshakable liberation of the heart. So not just moments of being non-reactive, but a liberation and a freedom that is unshakable because the roots of shakeability, if I use that word, in ignorance have gone. Have gone. The fires have cooled. It's a very high bar, and yet I think it's important to have high bars in our practice, to have that sense of possibility, the possibility of awakening for us. And it's really important to remember that the Buddha never sought to have perpetual students or followers. He sought for graduates. Yeah? He encouraged people to come to the same liberating insights that he had come to on his own path. So, in one way, we don't want to sort of devalue or deflate Nibbana into a kind of just a non-reactive state. But we have to be careful also not to overinflate it in a way in which that it seems impossible for us, because according to the Buddha and according to practitioners over time, this is possible for us.
Yeah, I got that idea from, I think it was Stephen Batchelor's Beyond Beliefs and Beyond Buddhism, and he talks about more or less using the word not having reactivity.
Yeah.
So if you take it out far enough on that spectrum, so it's continuous, I don't know. Anyway, I was just trying to get a better handle on it. But thank you.
Thank you. And Karsten.
Well, first, thank you for doing this course. It's really valuable, and I like the way you integrate practice and theory. I really appreciate that. I'll tell you what interests me. It actually moves in several directions. But one is, you mentioned at one point there are tastes of nirvana. And I perked up on that because I've had moments, I would describe them as moments in which there is no self. It's just there. And that could be a kind of taste of nirvana. But I want to go a little further than that. You know, I want to know a little bit about not what the obstructions are that you're removing, but what's the experience? Is it simply that there's no craving and no ill will and no delusion, no sense of self? Or is there an experience beyond that? And in the Pali Canons, it's described as sublime experience, unborn, as there's this sense of something incredibly transcendent.
Yeah.
When you remove the obstructions, the impediments, something is revealed that in some sense maybe was always there, or maybe it's constructed. I don't want to make any thoughts. I don't have any specific thoughts on that, but something quite incredible then comes to be. And is this simply something that is indescribable, or can you say more about it?
I mean, I think you would hear people respond in different ways to your reflection, because some people would speak about the experience of awakening, you know, a moment in time when there's a sudden shift in consciousness from, you know, seeing solidity to actually seeing emptiness everywhere. And some people would describe that as an experience. Other people would describe it as a sort of much more quiet deepening of understanding, but still transcendent and transforming. And I think, yes, we do have tastes. And I actually think nirvana is something we learn to practice. You know, what does it mean to liberate the moment? What does it mean to liberate this moment from, you know, the grip of craving, the grip of ill will, the grip of confusion? What does it mean to liberate this moment? So I think there's an element here where we turn it into something we practice. But I think for many people, hopefully for most people, there are also tastes. We do not go through our day constantly clinging or constantly caught in aversion. We do not go through our day constantly selfing. You know, there are many moments when that is actually not operative. And, you know, I think partially because we have a kind of negative attentional bias, you know, that focuses on the imperfect, that the moments of clinging and aversion and craving, they have very loud voices. The moments of stillness and non-clinging, non-craving, non-aversion have much quieter voices. So I think we kind of tend to gloss over them, you know, almost as if we're waiting for the next disaster, you know, or the next difficult moment. But I think it's really important to get a felt sense and a taste of those moments, to really explore that landscape. And how do we know it? There are moments of peace, often very deep peace. There can be moments of real stillness. There can be moments of real easefulness. There are moments when we're not caught up in the arguments with impermanence or dukkha or, you know, selfing and what it is. We're not caught up with the arguments. And when we're not caught up with the arguments, the mind comes to stillness. You know, that's a putting away of a lot of agitation. So I think it's twofold. There is a path and there is a fruition. And there's many small fruitions along the way. And I think it's really, I feel it's really important to highlight and to really intimately know those small fruitions along the way. Because quite frankly, they are cumulative.
But is there a point in which we get more than a than a series of tastes. Let me put it this
way. I would hope so.
Yeah, well, let me give one sort of skeptical thought about that.
Yeah.
Selfing. Certainly we want to find ways to get beyond selfing. But selfing is also necessary to navigate the world.
Yes, yes.
And as long as we're alive, I don't know how we can permanently extinguish selfing.
That's right. The Buddha didn't talk about no self.
Yeah.
And the Buddha talked about non-self. Mm-hmm. You know, so the Buddha didn't speak about annihilating self. He spoke about really uprooting, clinging to views of self. Mm-hmm. And positional selfing. Of course you need a navigational self to move through life. That's not an issue. And it doesn't cause dukkha. You know, it's quite helpful when I get up in the morning and, you know, I know who my partner is and I know where I live and I know which car I'm supposed to drive. It's actually quite useful. That's navigational selfing. It takes us to work. You know, it helps us to take care of life. It's not a cause of dukkha. It's not a cause of dukkha. What is really a cause of pain is clinging to views of self as being somehow central, solid, enduring, rather than seeing that clinging is always creating roots of self. I mean, and that's, of course, one aspect of self-making. And I mean, I don't want to give a discourse here, but there's another aspect of self-making, which is equally important, which is actually said to be one of the very last fetters to fall away, which is relational selfing in Pali is mana, you know, where I see myself to be somehow lesser or inferior to you, or I see myself somehow as being better and superior to you, or I see us all being equally deluded. And this kind of relational selfing, it tends to be much more unconscious, but its effect in our life is huge. You know, depending which camp we find ourselves in, you know, we might be the one who always sits at the back of the room, never asks a question. We might be the one who always feels that, you know, I'm right and I'm going to tell you that I'm right. We might be the one who has very low sense of aspiration. You know, we might be one who's constantly sort of inflating ourselves. But this is what comes to an end through understanding. And when that comes to an end through understanding, I think the world opens in a very different way. I think the eyes through which we see are quite transformed. And this is what the Buddha calls the third noble truth, the third ennobling truth, the end of dukkha. The end of feeling caught, the end of feeling imprisoned, the end of feeling so conditioned by everything that arises in the moment.
Thank you. That's really useful, especially the distinction between the navigational self and other forms of selfing.
Yeah, I mean, there's even a discourse when the Buddha speaks about cultivating identities that lead to the falling away of the unskillful, that lead cultivating identities that lead towards freedom and the end of confusion, and not cultivating identities that lead towards more of a sense of being imprisoned and the perpetuation of the unskillful. Yeah. Let's go to someone in chat. Okay.
I can read the next question in the chat. It's from Kim. It says, is nirvana non-conceptual awareness? Is there a right brain, left brain balance involved?
Well, there were no neuroscientists around at the time of the Buddha, so you know, I doubt if that discussion actually arose. I think it's more than non-conceptual awareness. I think we're talking about understanding here. We're talking about insight. That goes to the root of struggle and conflict and distress. So I think when we're talking more than just an awareness, we're talking about insight. And, you know, neuroscientists today know that that changes the brain. They know that it changes the neural pathways and how the brain is operating. Tony.
Thank you. I wanted to respond to your answer about delusion because I was kind of surprised as you were answering. I was thinking about the Mark Twain quote about it's not what you don't know that gets you in trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. And confusion, yeah, but I'm not confused about whether my breath is coming in or out, but I may be confused about, I don't know, the course of history or what's going on down the street or all kinds of speculative views. And those kinds of things people are really certain about, even though I've never found anybody who's been able to answer the question, what's going on really, with any degree of satisfaction. So I wondered if you might be able to distinguish between the kind of certainty or confidence that comes with direct experience and the kind of delusion that comes from believing our thoughts and being certain that we're right. You talked about people who think they're right and everybody's wrong. So that feels like a delusion to me as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's many layers to delusion, quite honestly. I think if you look at kind of like how the Buddha described sort of core delusion, it's about distortion. It's about not seeing things as they actually are. But it's more than that. I mean, there's real nuances to that. He says delusion is seeing the impermanent as being permanent. Delusion is about seeing the unlovely as being lovely. Delusion is about seeing self where there's an emptiness of self. So he really kind of began to, and seeing the unsatisfactory as being satisfactory. So he really began to unpack this word delusion into these nuances, which I think actually makes it more approachable, you know, where we can take that as an investigation, you know, how do I do that? You know, where do I see that in myself, seeing the impermanent as being permanent? Where do I see the unsatisfactory as being satisfactory? What are the moments when I'm seeing a solid self, when there's an emptiness of any of that solidity? What do I see as being lovely, which actually may not be lovely? Because I think these are the places, according to Buddhist teaching, these are the places that we get caught. And this is what kind of knocks us off balance and wondering, either taking the position of course I see things the way they are, or the position of, how could I have got it so wrong? Yeah.
And those things are certainties. I think this is permanent, or at least permanent for all practical purposes. And those are certainties that we think that, you know, satisfaction is still possible.
Yeah. Convincing.
Right. So I'm not as happy with the notion that it's that moha is confusion.
It's deeper than that.
Yeah.
It's deeper than that. And it lies in what the Buddha described in the word in Pali is vipalasa, or these core distortions that distort perception. And then because perception is distorted, our responses to what is being perceived are also distorted and don't deliver what we hope for. And actually, I think that's where the confusion comes in.
Okay.
That's where the confusion, why didn't it work? You know, why didn't my sort of pursuit of gratification and stimulation not make me happy? You know, so that's where the confusion comes in, I think, on the heels of the delusion.
Thank you.
I'm trying to keep track of order at hand, but I think Kathy, you...
Yes, thank you, Christina, and thank you so much for this course. I'm finding an incredibly useful discussion. I also find that with this course and the last one on the five spiritual powers, there are times that it's like, I want to read more. I want to study more. I'd like to know which are the key suttas that you are bringing your material from. And I don't think you should talk specifically about the suttas so much during the course, but maybe have an additional reading sort of thing. And have you considered that for this course and others?
I don't think it's that straightforward, Kathy, because, you know, when you look at the discourses, you don't find discourses that kind of will, one discourse that will focus on the five spiritual powers. Yes. You're going to find it woven through multiple discourses, you know. You won't find that one discourse. I mean, there are some discourses that are very dedicated, but many of the themes that we bring forward are actually woven through the entire Pali Canon, you know, rather than being dedicated. So it's not that easy to kind of, you know, say, oh, you know, here's a discourse you're looking for.
Yes, I didn't necessarily expect one, but some key ones and also some key commentaries, perhaps, that you have found helpful or that you guys have written yourselves.
Thank you. It is something to consider, you know, as a sort of ongoing support.
Yeah.
Because I know the discourses for a lot of people can feel kind of unapproachable, you know, like the Pali Canon is so huge and where do I start? And, you know, and there are places to start. I mean, I don't know if you've been on the reading list at Bodhi College.
Mm-hmm. No, actually I haven't. Yeah.
I mean, that might be useful to have a look at.
Okay, thank you. That's a good place to start. I mean, I would also go to Access to Insight and just put in Unshakable Liberation of the Heart.
Yeah,
you know, and see what comes up. There are so many ways to access online lately, yeah, which is so wonderful, such a resource. Thank you so much.
I mean, that's actually a useful approach to getting to know the discourses a bit, is to just put in, you know, one word, you know, a couple of words, wise intention, and it will bring forward Access to Insight or Sutta Central.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Stephanie, I don't know if you have a camera or not. Hi. You're muted, Stephanie.
There I go. I wanted to say that I'm really enjoying this course. There's something about the combination of your three different perspectives and the kind of material that you're presenting, which has given me a lot of understanding about what I was doing. I realized that I have had those moments.
Yeah.
You know, they were, I just feel okay. I feel all right. Everything's okay. Even when I don't feel so good, they just happen. And so you've given me like an understanding of what was happening then. And also from especially the meditation practices, but also some of the talks, I've begun to understand more that I was working too hard. I was trying too hard. That instruction about letting the thoughts end, seeing when they end, for some reason, that was very helpful, and I kind of released a lot of work, like effort. But I did have a question, which is that sometimes I have, say, anxious thoughts or hyperactive thoughts that are so many and so strong, it's like a storm, and I can't watch one. So I wanted to ask you what to do in that case.
I think that, you know, that Buddha was a realist, you know, and he recognized the sort of intractable nature of some of our repeat patterns. You know, might be anxiety thinking, might be, you know, rumination, but he recognizes. So he didn't ever just offer one pathway. He never just said, just let go of the thinking, you know. Instead, he offered really multiple approaches to how to liberate that moment when that is happening, you know. So this is not kind of theoretical. It's very practical, you know. So, you know, he would always start with, of course, we begin by being aware of what's going on. And then we might, you know, and then if mindfulness alone is not enough, you know, we might want to investigate. You know, how do I know this anxiety? Where do I see it in the body? How is it imprinting? How is it registering? And then he goes on, it goes through a very long list. I won't go through them all. He says, you know, if it still arises, you know, take your attention elsewhere. Take your attention elsewhere. Don't try to go into this. Don't try to do something with this. Just take your attention elsewhere. And to somewhere where you can anchor, somewhere you can connect. He says, it still arises, you know, cultivate what's missing. Calm, spaciousness, stillness, collectedness, gatheredness, you know. And then he goes on, and if it still arises, you know, sometimes he says, ask for help. Sometimes he says, put your tongue against your roof of your mouth and don't go there, you know. But it was a clear recognition that we probably have more return visitors in our
minds. How do you cultivate calm if you're hyper-anxious?
You start with the body. You might start with walking. You might start with the body. You might start looking in the body at what is calm. You know, when we're in that state of agitation, you know, we miss the places in the body that are actually calm right now. Your earlobes. Rarely agitated. And you start to actually bring your attention quite consciously to where calm is present. And to gather, foreground that, highlight that, gather around that, rather than continuing to feed the energy and the attention into the agitation and the anxiety.
Yes, I see. Thank you.
And you said, you know, you realize that you have more moments than you appreciated, you know, of things, you know, loosening their grip. I think it's really important to notice that, you know. I think one of the, when the Buddha speaks about joyfulness, he talks about, you know, knowing the joyfulness of the unskillful and the habitual falling away. And, you know, most people don't have like epiphany moments when suddenly, oh, that's fallen away, you know. For many more people, it's a quiet deepening of understanding. Sometimes we don't even know there's been more understanding until we go into a situation that's previously been charged and filled with reactivity. We suddenly realize we're approaching this in a very different way. And I would hope as people practice that we do see things fall away. You know, you might suddenly realize, oh, I'm more patient, or I'm less judgmental. Or
actually, that has happened to me. It's yes. So beautiful.
Yes, and things fall away. And it's not that they're just hiding somewhere waiting to come back. They are actually falling away. And that is something to find joyfulness in.
So it's a question of bringing awareness to that.
And yes. it's also I think deepening in confidence, because if I can see this fall away, really, where is the end of that falling away? And you begin to have confidence that maybe it's possible.
That's true. It's so easy to focus on the things that are bothering you and not the things that you don't have to worry about anymore.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Sarah, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for this class. It's been really enriching. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
So I was actually finding it really hard to ask you what I wanted to ask you. And I think it's because of this kind of taboo surrounding actually talking about this. And also I can feel like a construction of self in just the posing of a question, which is maddening. But then as I'm hearing questions that are, you know, like skepticism, it occurred to me maybe that's because people don't talk about it. And I was just wondering if there's a skillful way to talk about this with each other. I've even been told before not to talk about this. And I just, what do we do?
Well, I think I would really encourage more conversation around this. You know, I know, like, when I've taught more around, like, the cultivation of joyfulness and people have conversations about it, suddenly they're much more joyful, you know? And, I also think it's really helpful to sit down with Dharma friends and, you know, just have a conversation and, you know, a shared reflection on, you know, how do we understand Nibbana? You know, how does this come about? You know, what do people say about Nibbana? What does it look like? I think it's a really, I think we need more of these conversations, not less. I mean, I think that there's often being kind of, you know, prohibitions, you know, about not claiming to be awakened, you know, or not claiming to have this, but I think that's very different than having these conversations that really bring us back, I think, to the heart of the path. And, you know, what are you aiming for in this path? You know, what is your sense of goal or, you know, fruition? What does that look like for you? What does that mean for you? I think they're really inspiring and helpful conversations to have. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'll pop us back into the chat. The next question says, I've been hearing over the years about cultivation of various qualities, as in this course, but I've also been hearing the term natural unfolding. Can you say something about the coexistence of cultivation and natural unfolding?
Well, when natural unfolding, I mean, it's an unusual term, natural unfolding, but it requires certain things to be in place for there to be any unfolding at all. You know, I mean, if it was just natural unfolding and nothing needed to be in place, then we would see that natural unfolding all around us. And we don't. So there are things that need to be in place for that natural unfolding to happen, as sometimes it's spoken about in some Mahayana traditions. You know, it's not just sit back in my armchair and wait, you know, for this great unfolding to happen. There's the assumption that there are many things in place in terms of integrity, in terms of understanding, in terms of teaching, a sense of the path, in terms of the effort that we actually bring to support that natural unfolding. So it's not separate from the path of cultivation in my mind.
We have a couple others in the chat as well, and we do still have 15 minutes, so feel free to raise your hands, everyone, if you have more questions. But I'll move on to the next one that we have in the chat, which is from Noor, and it says, I've heard from Mahayana tradition that, quote, if your enlightenment is as you expected it to be, it is a dubious enlightenment, end quote. This resonates for me, and I wonder if/how this fits in with the approach in this course.
I've never heard that quote before, so I'm not quite sure what it's alluding to. So I have to confess, I don't really think I can respond to that.
That's an interesting quote, nonetheless. The next question. The next question is from Michael. I'm not sure if he was asking a question in response to something that we were speaking about at the time, but it says, delusion of what? Not understanding and accepting impermanence, no separate self, the Four Noble Truths.
All of that. All of that is manifestation of delusion. All of that is going back to some of these. I mean, I mentioned the four distortions. But the Buddha went on to describe delusion as believing that we live in a random universe, you know, where our actions have no consequences. Not understanding that the Four Noble Truths, not understanding that the roots of struggle and distress, not understanding that the three characteristics. So the Buddha was pretty detailed in kind of describing what delusion is, which we don't see. What we often see more on the surface is the confusion part. You know, how did this happen? How did I end up here again? That sense of bewilderment of why don't my life strategies work? I think what we often experience much more firsthand is the confusion part that, you know, says, you know, this shouldn't be happening. Things shouldn't change. This shouldn't happen to me, you know, and, you know, I am like this. I think what we experience is more on the confusion part. And I think would be my distinction. You know, I think the great gift of the Buddha's teaching is to take the bewilderment out of life. You know, instead of finding ourselves saying, how did I end up here in this state of struggle or distress, often followed by the word again, as we look more closely, we begin to understand just how we ended up there. And I think in beginning to understand how we ended up in these places that are often far from where we wish to be, that's almost like where the path begins. I think that the Buddha was so passionate about understanding the architecture of distress. And it was very clear that if we're going to understand the architecture of distress, then we need to understand the architecture of our own personal world of experience and how that is constructed and built and shaped and fabricated moment to moment. And in a way that is the path, that is the path. It is really bringing that understanding to the foreground. Yeah. Carol.
Yeah, thanks, Christina. I find your teachings very helpful and I'm grateful for them. Ever since I began the course, I've been thinking about my relationship to nirvana in relation to my practice and how I think about it. And I guess a long time ago, I just decided to try to keep up a steady practice and to let what comes come. And I have had some wonderful, very brief, what Joseph Goldstein calls mini nirvana experiences. But I haven't weighted my practice with a lot of expectations or striving. For me, that seems like the wise thing to do, but I'm wondering what you would think.
I think there's two sides to this. You know, I think we can carry levels of expectation that kind of turn us away from seeing what's right in front of us, that we're always mm-hmm. leaning forward into a better moment or, you know, right. a more ideal moment. And that's a kind of expectation that's not helpful to us. But I personally think it's realistic to have expectations in this path. I mean, none of us do this to stay the same, do we? You know, none of us do this to sort of simply be more intimately acquainted with our own disasters. I think if we're quite upfront about us, we have expectations. We have aspirations.
Yes.
We have longings. And I think this is really something to be honored and to be respected. rather than to be, you know, have all these warnings about don't have any expectations and you won't be disappointed. Mm-hmm. If we didn't have aspirations, we wouldn't be doing this because it's not always an easy path to walk, you know? And in many ways, it's our aspirations, I think, that keep us going. I mean, you may have heard me use this quote before that, you know, when a ship has no destination, there are no favorable winds.
That's great.
Yeah, I think it's really true, you know. If we don't know where we're going, we actually don't know what to draw on. We don't know what helps us. We don't know what supports us, you know. So it's really helpful to know where we're going.
Well, I think I've always had an aspiration to move along the path of awakening.
Good.
But not to be judging, oh, I haven't come to the supreme moment.
No.
Yeah.
No, that would not be helpful. But it's also not helpful not to not acknowledge how far you have come on the path.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
We do have some more questions in the chat as well, so I might jump in and read one of those. This one's from Todd, and he says, what is a good way to approach the concept of unshakability in the context of our daily responsibilities, such as family, capitalism?
I think we have to remember about the classroom of cultivating unshakability. And, you know, the Buddha didn't just talk about some sort of dissociated, transcendent state. You know, he talked about, you know, that our life is our classroom. You know, and I think we look quite closely at the moments when we feel very shaken or very overturned, you know, or very, very lost. And we know, okay, that's my classroom right here. You know, it's in the midst of this that I start to explore. What does it mean to know my feet are actually touching the ground? That's a good starting point. You know, what does it mean to feel that actually I am breathing and I can be here? That's a good starting point. You know, what does it mean to remember that there might be another way of being present than just being overwhelmed? You know, that's a good starting point. So I think it's really, you know, because, you know, and it's very important not to romanticize, you know, living in a cave or somehow being secluded from the world. Believe me, I've spent enough time in monasteries to know that they have their own classrooms, you know. And if we're living in this world as we do, then we learn to turn towards it. And, you know, we look at where are the moments of being shaken, being overwhelmed, and what can I cultivate in the midst of that? You know, one of my favorite and much used, maybe overused, phrases in teaching is in the midst of, you know, in the midst of this chaos, or in the midst of this life I'm living, or in the midst of this difficulty, where am I going to make my home? What is going to be cultivated just now? Rather than, you know, waiting. I remember when I was teaching in the beginning of COVID, you know, in the lockdowns, and I kept returning to this theme of saying, you know, this is not a waiting room. You know, we can't live as if we're waiting for this to be over so our life can begin. This is our life just now. And it's not a waiting room where we postpone our path until we can somehow have a different kind of life. This is it. This is it. And this is where we're really asked to be awake and to practice nibbana, you know, and to find the freedom in a way where we don't feel so hostage to the world of conditions. Yes, we're all vulnerable to the world of conditions that we live in. And it's important that we're vulnerable because then we're touched by life. And that's the ground of compassion and the ground of responsiveness. But there's a big difference between knowing that we're vulnerable to this world of conditions that we often can't control and actually feeling to be a prisoner of that world of conditions. You know, that if the conditions are a certain way, I can be happy. If conditions are another way, I'm only unhappy. You know, that we actually can find a way of not being a hostage, not being a prisoner, while remaining so connected and engaged. And, you know, that's a huge art, a huge invitation. It's a big ask. But, you know, we live in times where, you know, this is what's being asked of us. This is what's being asked of us. Yeah.
Karsten, I can see that you put your question in the chat as well. There's a few others which I can read, but why don't you go ahead and ask?
Question in the chat. It sort of crystallized what I was trying to ask in the first time, which is there an experience of nirvana that is more than simply falling away of the impediments, some kind of transcendent experience, which is not merely their absence?
The Buddha never talked about nirvana as a transcendent state. He talked about something that is lived.
But he uses metaphors that often suggest a transcendent state, in the Udana, for example.
They're suggestive of a very profound transformation of consciousness, but they're not dissociated.
Mm-hmm. But that profound transformation of consciousness must be experienced not just as a negative, an absence of.
Oh, no, it's not just a negative. It's not just an absence of. You know, where the Buddha speaks about the fruitions of nirvana, you know, in terms of, you know, the deepest peace, the deepest happiness, the deepest coolness, the deepest stillness, the deepest wakefulness. You know, he uses plenty of words to describe nirvana. It's not just the absence of things, but he doesn't talk about a state.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that can be, you know, can be a bit kind of dicey to be, you know, pursuing our own Bodhi tree experience, rather than cultivating understanding. Is there something else? I think we have time for one more, Brittany, if there's something in the chat.
Yes, we have a question from Miranda. She says, I can readily see practicing nibbana off the cushion. Specifics on practicing it during meditation?
I think it comes down to how we focus our intentionality. You know, because you're not going, you know, I talk about liberating the moment. Well, let's translate that into practice. You know, let's translate that into looking at, okay, practicing about liberating the moment from what? From delusion, from clinging, you know? So maybe I start to notice, okay, what does clinging look like? How do I know it? How do I know that contractedness of clinging? What does it mean to liberate that? If we speak about nirvana as the blowing out of the fires of hatred, then I might have that intention in my practice for a period of time. I begin to notice all the small and large moments of ill will, you know, of aversion. And I begin to notice they're my classroom, you know. This is where I cultivate, and I could call it non-ill will, but this is where I cultivate kindness. This is where I cultivate metta. This is where I cultivate compassion. I might turn the blowing out of the fires of greed. I turn that into a lived practice. I start to notice all those small and large moments on and off the cushion, you know, where the mind is really has this impulse of just this endless wanting, you know, this endless wanting, this not enough. And I begin to question those moments, you know, and to question, you know, is there enough in this moment? for compassion? Is there enough in this moment for kindness? Is there enough in this moment for contentment? Is there enough in this moment for joyfulness? And beginning to see that the falling away of the unskillful, because we cultivate those moments of practice in Nirvana in the classroom of the unskillful. And that is the end of our time. Thank you. Thank you so much for your questions. Thank you so much for joining. Thank you for continuing in this exploration. And thank you, Brittany, for holding this space.
My pleasure. Thank you, everyone. I hope to see you all for our next Q&A, which is just under 2 weeks from now with John and Jake on Tuesday, December 17th at 2 p.m. Eastern. And thank you so much, Christina. What a pleasure.
Yes, enjoy, everyone. Be well, travel safely.
Thank you.
Thank you.